is to attack, he will never be able, Poutrincourt said. Delenn displayed so little curiosity about what Poutrincourt inserted that Steeply wondered if he had some French on the sly, and made a private ideogram to this effect. Postlethwaite's a pure defensive strategist. He's got a gestalt. The term we use here for a complete game is either gestalt or complete game. Stice aced Hal out wide on the ad court again, and the ball got stuck in an interstitial diamond in the chain-link fencing, and Hal had to put his stick down and use both hands to force the thing out. Maybe for your article, though, the poop on this kid, the punter's brother, Hal can't lob half as good as even Postlethwaite, and compared to Ortho or Mike, his net play's pedestrian. But unlike his brother when he was here, see, Hal's strengths have started to fit together. He's got a great serve, a great return of serve, and great, great ground strokes with great control and great touch, great command of touch and spin. And he can take a defensive player and yank the kid around with his superior control, and he can take an attacking player and use the guy's own pace against him. Hal passed Stice off the backhand down the line, and the ball looked sure to land fair, and then at the last possible second, it veered out. An abrupt, tight curve out of bounds, as if some freak gust came out of nowhere and blew it out. And Stice looked more surprised than Hal did. The punter's brother's face registered nothing as he stood at the ad corner, adjusting something on his strings.
But perhaps one does attain this, to win. Imagine you. You become just what you have given your life to be. Not merely very good, but the best. The good philosophy of here and Stitt, I believe this philosophy of Anfield is more Canadian than American, so you may see I have prejudice, is that you must have also, so leave to one side for a moment the talent and work to become best. That you are doomed if you do not have also within you some ability to transcend the goal.
276.
Transcend the success of the best, if you get to there.
Steeply could see, off in the parking lot behind the hideous, bulging Neo-Georgian cube of the Community and Administration building, several small boys carrying and dragging white plastic bags to the nest of dumpsters that abutted the pines at the parking lot's rear. The children pale and wild-eyed, and conferring among themselves and casting anxious looks across the grounds at the crowd behind the show court.
Then, Poutrincourt said, and for the ones who do become the étoiles, the lucky who become profiled and photographed for readers and in the USA religion make it, they must have something built into them along the path that will let them transcend it, or they are doomed. We see this in experience. One sees this in all obsessive goal-based cultures of pursuit. Look at the Japonois, the suicide rates of their latter years. This task of us at the Anfield is more delicate still, with the... For you, if you attain your étoile, goal, and cannot find some way to transcend the experience of having that goal be your entire existence, your raison de faire.
277.
So then, one of two things we see will happen.
Steeply had to keep breathing on the pen to keep the point thawed.
One is that you attain the goal and realize the shocking realization that attaining the goal does not complete or redeem you. Does not make everything for your life okay, as you are in the culture, educated to assume it will do this goal. And then you face this fact, that what you had thought would have the meaning, does not have the meaning when you get it, and you are impaled by shock. We see suicides in history by people at these pinnacles. The children here are versed in what is called the Saga of Eric Clipperton.
With two P's?
Just so. Or the other possibility of doom for the étoile who attain. They attain the goal, thus, and put as much equal passion into celebrating their attainment as they had put into pursuing the attainment. This is called here the syndrome of the endless party. The celebrity, money, sexual behaviors, drugs and substances, the glitter. They become celebrities instead of players. and because they are celebrities only as long as they feed the culture of Gaul's hunger for the make it, the winning, they are doomed. Because you cannot both celebrate and suffer, and play is always suffering, just so. Our best boy is better than Hal. You'll see him play tomorrow if you want. John Wayne. No relation to the real John Wayne. A fellow compatriot of Terry here. Aubrey DeLint was sitting back up beside them, the cold giving his pitted cheeks a second flush. Two feverish harlequin ovals. John Wayne's got a gestalt because Wayne simply got everything, and everything with him's got the sort of pace that a touch artist and thinker like Hal just can't handle.
This was the founder's philosophy, too, of Doom, the punter in Candenza's father, who also, I am being told, dabbled in filming? Steeply asked the Canadian.
Poutrincourt's shrug could have meant too many things to note.
I came after. Monsieur Stitt, his different goal for the Etoile is to walk between these.
Nor did Steeply quite notice the woman's shifts between dialects.
To map out some path between needing the success and mockery making of the success.
Dillant leaned in. Wayne's got everything. Hal's strength has become knowing he doesn't have everything, and constructing a game as much out of what's missing as what's there. Steeply pretended to arrange the cap, but was really adjusting the wig.
It all sounds awfully abstract for something so physical.
Poutrincourt's shrug pushed her glasses slightly up.
It is contradictory. Two selves, one not there. Monsieur Stitt, when the Academy founder died.
The punter's father, who dabbled in films?
Steeply's raglan sweater had been his wife's. Again, nodding blandly, Poutrincourt.
This academic founder, Monsieur Stitt, tells that this founder was a student of types of sight.
Dillon said, Wayne's only possible limits being also his strength. The tungsten steel will and resolve, the insistence on imposing his game and his will on his man, totally unwilling to change the pace of his game if he's not doing good. Wayne's got the touch and the lobs to hang back on an off day, but he won't. If he's down or things are going his way, he just hits harder. His pace is so overwhelming he can get away with being uncompromising about attack against North American juniors. But in the show, which Wayne'll go pro maybe as soon as next year, in the show, flexibility is more important, he'll find. Humility. Poutrincourt was looking at Steeply almost too carelessly, it almost seemed.
The studying was not so much how one sees a thing, but this relation between oneself and what one sees. He translated this numerously across different fields, Monsieur Stitt tells.
The son described his father as, quote, genre dysphoric.
Poutrincourt cocked her head.
This does not sound like Al in Candenza.
Dillant sniffed meatily. But Wayne's gestalt's chief edge over Hal is the head. Wayne is pure force. He doesn't feel fear, pity, remorse. When a point's over, it might as well have never happened. For Wayne. Hal actually has finer groundstrokes than Wayne. And he could have Wayne's pace if he wanted. But the reason Wayne is 3 continentally and Hal's 6 is the head. Hal looks just as perfectly dead out there, but he's more vulnerable in terms of, like, emotionally. Hal remembers points, senses trends in a match. Wayne doesn't. Hal's susceptible to fluctuations, discouragement. Set long lapses in concentration. Some days you can almost see Hal, like, flit in and out of a match, like some part of him leaves and hovers and then comes back. The Trolch person said, Holy crow!
So to survive here for later is, finally, to have it both ways.
Terry Poutrincourt said quietly, in nearly accentless English, as if to herself. This emotional susceptibility in terms of forgetting being more commonly a female thing. Stitt and I think it's a will issue. Susceptible wills are more common to the top girls here. We see it in Longley. We see it in Millie Kent and Franny Unwin. We don't see this forgetful will in the Vaughts, or in Spodek, who you can watch if you want. The Trolch person said,
Could we see that again, Ray, do you think?
Steeply was looking at the side of Putrin Court's face as Delent on the other side was saying, "But the one we see this most in is Hal." The 14th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. The Man-O-War Grill on Prospect. Maddie sat in the hot clatter of the Portuguese restaurant with his hands in his lap, looking at nothing. A waiter brought his soup. The waiter had bits of either bloodstain or soup on his apron, and for no discernible reason wore a fez. Maddie ate his soup without once slurping. He'd been the neat eater in the family. Maddie Pemulis was a prostitute, and today he was 23. The Man-O-War Grill is on Prospect Street in Cambridge, and its front windows overlook the heavy foot traffic between Inman and Central Squares. As Maddie waited for his soup, he'd seen across the restaurant and out the front's glass a bag lady type, older female in several clothing layers, lift her skirts and lower herself to the pavement and move her scaggly old bowels right there in full view of passers-by and diners both, then gather all her plastic shopping bags together and walk stolidly out of view. The pile of bowel movement sat there on the pavement, steaming slightly. Maddie'd heard the college kids at the next table say they didn't know whether to be totally illed or totally awed. A big rangy kid with a big sharp face and tight short hair and a smile and a shave twice jaw since he was 14, now balding smoothly back from a high, clear forehead. A permanent smile that always seemed like he was trying not to, but just couldn't help it. His da always formally saying to wipe it off. Inman Square, Little Lisbon. The soup has bits of calamari that make the muscles in his face flex, chewing. Now two Brazilians in bell-bottoms and tall shoes along the sidewalk, across the window over the diner's heads. What might be a brewing street fight. One walking forward and one walking backward, facing off as they move, each missing the dollop of bowel movement on the walk, speaking high-volume street Portuguese, muffled by windows and hot clatter, but each looking around and then pointing at his own chest like, "You saying this shit to me?" Then the forward man's sudden charge carrying them both past the window's right frame. Maddie's dad come over on a boat from Louth in Leinster in 1989. Maddie'd been 3 or 4. Dodd worked on the Southie docks, coiling lengths of rope as big around as phone poles into tall cones, and had died when Maddie was 17 of pancreatic complaints. Maddie looked up from the roll he was dipping in the soup and saw two underweight, interracial girls moving across the window. One, a nigger, neither even looking at the shit everyone stepping around, and then a few seconds behind them, poor Tony Kraus, who, because of the trousers and cap, Maddie didn't even recognize as poor Tony Kraus until he'd looked back down and then up again. Poor Tony Kraus looked god-awful. Sucked out. Hollow-eyed. Past ill. Grave-ready. His face's skin the greenish-white of extreme-depth marine life. Looking less alive than undead. Identifiable as poor old poor Tony. Only by the boa and red leather coat and the certain way he held his hand to his throat's hollow as he walked. That way, Equus Reis always said always reminded him of black-and-white era starlets descending curved stairs into some black tie function. Kraus never so much walking as making an infinite series of grand entrances into pocket after pocket of space. A queenly hauteur, now both sickening and awesome given Kraus's spectral mien, passing across the grill's window, his eyes either on or looking right through the two skinny girls plodding ahead of him, following them out of the window's right-hand side. His dad begun fucking Maddie up the ass when Maddie was 10. A fookin' to boom. Maddie had complete recall of the whole thing. He'd seen sometimes where persons that had unpleasant things happen to them as children blocked the unpleasantness out in their mentality as adults and forgot it. Not so with Maddie Pemulis. He remembered every inch and pimple of every single time. His father outside the little room Matt and Mickey slept in, late at night. The cat's eye sliver of lit hallway through the crack in the door Dodd opened, the door on well-oiled hinges opening with the implacable slowness of a rising moon. Da's shadow lengthening across the floor, and then the man, his very self, weaving in behind it. Crossing the moonlit floor in darned socks, and that smell about him that later Maddie'd know was malt liquor, but at that age he and Mickey called something else when they smelled it. Maddie lay and pretended to sleep. He didn't know why tonight he pretended not to know the man was there. He was afraid. Even the first time, Mickey just 5. All the times were the same. Da, drunk, tacking across the bedroom floor, a certain stealth, managing somehow never to break his neck on the toy trucks and tiny cars scattered on the floor, left there that first time by accident. Sitting on the edge of the bed so his weight changed the bed's angle. A big man smelling of tobacco and something else, his breath always audible when drunk. Sitting on the edge of the bed, shaking Maddie awake, to the point where Maddie'd have to pretend to wake up, asking if he'd been asleep. Sleeping, there was he. Tenderness, caresses that were somehow just over the line from true ethnic Irish fatherly affection. The emotional largesse of a man without a green card who daily broke his back for his family's food. Caresses that were in some vague way just over the line from that, and from the emotional largesse of something else, drunk, when all the rules of mood were suspended and you never knew from minute to minute whether you were to be kissed or hit. Impossible to say how, or even know how, they were just over those lines. But they were the caresses. Tenderness, caresses, low, soft, oversweet, hot, bad breath. Soft apologies for some flash of savagery or discipline from the day. A way of cupping the pillow-warm cheek and jaw in the hollow of the hand. The huge pinky finger, tracing the hollow between throat and jaw. Maddie'd shrink away. Shy, are we, son? Scared, are we? Maddie'd shrink away even after he knew the shrinking fear was part of what brought it on, for Dodd get angry. Who are we scared of, then? Then who are we, a son, to be scared so of our own da? As if the da that broke daily his back were nothing more than a... Can't a da show his son some love without being taken for a... As if Maddie could lie here with his food inside him under bedding he'd paid for and think his da were no better than a...
Is it a fucking you're scared of, then? You think a da what comes in to speak to his son and holds him as a da has naught on his mind but the fook? As if the son were some $40 whore off the docks. As if the da were a... Is that what you take me for? Is that what you take me for, then?
Maddie shrinking back into a flattening pillow the Dodd paid for, the springs of the convertible bed singing with his fear, he shook.
Why then, so then I've a mind to give you just what you're thinking to fear. Take me for.
Maddie knew early on that his being afraid fueled the thing somehow, made his doll want to. He was unable not to be afraid. He tried and tried, cursed himself for a coward and deserving, all but calling his father a... It was years before he snapped to the fact that his dad have fooked him into boom, no matter what he'd done. That the event was laid out before the first slim line of doorlight broadened, and whatever Maddie'd felt or betrayed made no difference. An advantage to not blocking it out is you can snap to things later, with maturer perspective. You can come to see that no soon on the planet could in any way ask for that, regardless. At a certain later age, he started lying there when his da shook him and pretended to sleep on, even when the shakes got to where his teeth clacked together in a mouth that wore the slight smile Maddie decided truly sleeping people's faces always wore. The harder his father shook him, the tighter Maddie'd shut his eyes, and the more set the slight smile, and the louder the rasps of the cartoon snores he alternated with exhaled whistles. Mickey, over in the cot by the window, always silent as a tomb, on his side, face to the wall and hidden. Never a word between them about anything more than the chances of being kissed versus hit. Finally, Dodd grabbed both his shoulders and flipped him over with a sound of disgust and frustration. Maddie thought just the smell of the fear was maybe enough to deserve it. Until, later on, he got some maturer perspective. He remembered the oval sound of the cap coming off the jar of petroleum jelly, that special stone-in-pond plop of a Vaseline cap. Not childproof, even in an era of childproof caps. Hearing his da muttering as he applied it to himself, feeling the ice-cold, awful cold finger between him as his da smeared the stuff roughly around Maddie's rosebud, his dark star. It was only the maturer perspective of years and experience that let Maddie find something to be thankful for, that the Dodd at least used a lube. The origins of the big man's clear familiarity with the stuff and its nighttime use, not even adult perspective could illuminate, let Maddie snap to still now at 23. One hears, say, cirrhosis and acute pancreatitis and thinks of the subject clutching his middle like an old film's gut-shot actor and slumping quietly over to eternal rest with lids shut and face composed. Maddie's Dodd died choking on aspirated blood, a veritable fountain of the darkest possible blood. Maddie coated a spray paint russet as he held the man's yellow wrists, and Mum lumbered off down the ward in search of a crash cart team. Particles aspirated so terribly fine, like almost atomized, so that they hung in the air like the air itself over the cribbed bed as the man expired, cat-yellow eyes wide open, and face screwed into the very most god-awful, rictusized grin of pain. His last thoughts, if any, unknowable. Maddie still toasted the man's final memory with his first shot, whenever he indulged.
278.
The 11th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. First thing after supper, Hal drops around to Stitt's room off the ComAd lobby to go through the motions of getting some input on just what had gone so terribly wrong against Stice. Also to get, maybe, some kind of bead on why he'd had to play the darkness publicly in the first place, so close to the Whataburger. That is, like, what the exhibition might have signified. This endless tension among ETAs about how the coaches are seeing you, gauging your progress. Is your stock going up or down? But Ada Lint's the only one in there, working on some sort of oversized, spread sheetish chart, lying prone and shirtless on the bare floor with his chin in his hand and a pungent magic marker, and says Stitt has gone off on the cycle somewhere after confections, but to sit down. Presumably meaning in a chair. So Hal's subjected to several minutes of DeLint's take on the match, complete with stats out of the prorector's head. DeLint's back is pale and constellated with red pits of old pimples, though the back's nothing compared to Strux's or Shaw's back. There's a cane chair and a wood chair. DeLint's liquid crystal laptop screen pulses grayly on the floor next to him. Stitt's room's overlit, and there's no dust anywhere, not even in the very corners. Stitt's sound system's lights are on, but nothing's playing. Neither Hal nor DeLint mentions Oren's profiler's presence in the match's stands, nor the big lady's long interchange with Poutrincourt, which had been conspicuous. Stice's and Wayne's names are at the top of the huge chart on the floor, but Hal's name isn't. Hal says he can't tell whether he's made some sort of basic tactical error, or whether he just wasn't quite up to snuff this afternoon or what. "You just never quite occurred out there, kid," DeLint apprises him. He has regressed certain figures to back this up, this non-occurrence. His choice of words chills Hal to the root. After which, during what's supposed to be mandatory PM study period, and despite the three chapters of boards prep his boards prep schedule calls for, Hal sits alone up in viewing room 6, the bad leg out along the couch in front of him, flexing the bad ankle idly, holding the other leg's knee to his chest, squeezing a ball but with the hand he doesn't play with, chewing Kodiak and spitting directly into an unlined wastebasket, his expression neutral, watching some cartridges of his late father's entertainments. Anyone else looking at him in there tonight would call Hal depressed. He watches several cartridges all in a row. He watches The American Century as Seen Through a Brick and Prenuptial Agreement of Heaven and Hell, and then part of "Valuable coupon has been removed," which is maddening because it's all a monologue from some bespectacled little contemporary of Miles Penn and Heath Pearson, who was almost as ubiquitous as Reet and Bane in himself's work, but whose name right now Hal can't for the life of him recall. He watches parts of Death in Scarsdale, and Union of Publicly Hidden in Lynn, and Various Small Flames, and Kinds of Pain. The viewing room has insulated paneling behind the wallpaper and is essentially soundproof. Hal watches half of the Medusa versus Odalisque thing, but takes it out abruptly when people in the audience start getting turned to stone. Hal tortures himself by imagining swarthy, leering types threatening to torture various loved ones if Hal can't come up with the name of the kid in Valuable Coupon and Low Temperature Civics and Wave Bye-Bye to the Bureaucrat. There are two cartridges on VR6's glass shelves of himself getting interviewed in various arty community access cable-type forums, which Hal declines to watch. The light's slight flicker and subtle change in the pressure of the room is from the ETA furnaces kicking on way down in the tunnels below ComAd. Hal shifts uneasily on the couch, spitting into the waste can. The very faint smell of burnt dust is also from the furnace. A minor short didactic one Hal likes and runs twice in a row is Wave Bye-Bye to the Bureaucrat. A bureaucrat in some kind of sterile fluorescent-lit office complex is a fantastically efficient worker when awake, but he has this terrible problem waking up in the AM and is consistently late to work, which in a bureaucracy is idiosyncratic and disorderly and wholly unacceptable, and we see this bureaucrat getting called into a supervisor's pebbled glass cubicle, and the supervisor, who wears a severely dated leisure suit with his shirt collar flaring out on either side of its rust-colored lapels, tells the bureaucrat that he's a good worker and a fine man, but that this chronic tardiness in the AM is simply not going to fly. And if it happens one more time, the bureaucrat is going to have to find another fluorescent-lit office complex to work in. It's no accident that in a bureaucracy, getting fired is called termination, as in ontological erasure. And the bureaucrat leaves his supervisor's cubicle, duly shaken. That night, he and his wife go through their Bauhaus condominium, collecting every alarm clock they own, each one of which is electric and digital and extremely precise, and they festoon their bedroom with them. So there are like a dozen timepieces with their digital alarms all set for 0615 hours. But that night, there's a power failure, and all the clocks lose an hour or just sit there blinking 0100 hours over and over, and the bureaucrat still oversleeps the next AM. He wakes late, lies there for a moment staring at a blinking 0000. He shrieks, clutches his head, throws on wrinkled clothes, ties his shoes in the elevator, shaves in the car, blasting through red lights on the way to the commuter rail. The 0816 train to the city pulls into the station's lower level, just as the crazed bureaucrat's car screeches into the station's parking lot, and the bureaucrat can see the top of the train sitting there, idling from across the open lot. This is the very last temporally feasible train. If the bureaucrat misses this train, he'll be late again and terminated. He hauls into a handicap spot and leaves the car there at a crazy angle, vaults the turnstile, and takes the stairs down to the platform seven at a time, sweaty and bug-eyed. People scream and dive out of his way. As he careers down the long stairway, he keeps his crazed eyes on the open doors of the 0816 train, willing them to stay open just a little longer. Finally, filmed in a glacial slow-mo, the bureaucrat leaps from the seventh to the bottom step and lunges toward the train's open doors, and right in mid-lunge, smashes headlong into an earnest-faced little kid with thick glasses and a bow tie and those nerdy little schoolboy shorts, who's tottering along the platform under a tall armful of carefully wrapped packages. Ker-wham! They collide. Bureaucrat and kid both stagger back from the impact. The kid's packages go flying all over the place. The kid recovers his balance and stands there, stunned, glasses
and bow tie askew.
279.
The bureaucrat looks frantically from the kid to the litter of packages, to the kid, to the train's doors, which are still open. The train thrums. Its interior is fluorescent lit and filled with employed, ontologically secure, bureaucrats. You can hear the station's PA announcer saying something tinny and garbled about departure. The stream of platform foot traffic opens around the bureaucrat and the stunned boy and the litter of packages. Ogilvied once lectured for a whole period on this kid's character as an instance of the difference between an antagonist and a deuteragonist in moral drama. He'd mentioned the child actor's name over and over. Hal tries thwacking himself just over the right eye several times to dislodge the name. The film's bureaucrat's buggy eyes keep going back and forth between the train's open doors and the little kid, who's looking steadily up at him, almost studious, his eyes big and liquid behind the lenses. Hal doesn't remember who played the bureaucrat either, but it's the kid's name that's driving him bats. The bureaucrat's leaning away, inclined way over toward the train doors, as if his very cells were being pulled that way. But he keeps looking at the kid, the gifts, struggling with himself. It's a clear internal conflict moment, one of himself's film's very few. The bureaucrat's eyes suddenly recede back into their normal places in his sockets. He turns from the fluorescent doors and bends to the kid and asks if he's okay, and says it'll all be okay. He cleans the kid's spectacles with his pocket handkerchief, picks the kid's packages up. About halfway through the packages, the PA issues something final, and the train's doors close with a pressurized hiss. The bureaucrat gently loads the kid back up with packages, neatens them. The train pulls out. The bureaucrat watches the train pull out, expressionless. It's anybody's guess what he's thinking. He straightens the kid's bow tie, kneeling down the way adults do when they're ministering to a child, and tells him he's sorry about the impact and that it's okay. He turns to go. The platform's mostly empty now. Now, the strange moment. The kid cranes his neck around the packages and looks up at the guy as he starts to walk away.
"Mister," the kid says, "are you Jesus?"
"Don't I wish," the ex-bureaucrat says over his shoulder, walking away, as the kid shifts the packages and frees one little hand to wave bye at the guy's top coat's back as the camera, revealed now as mounted on the 0816's rear, recedes from the platform and picks up speed. Wave bye-bye to the bureaucrat remains Mario's favorite of all their late father's entertainments, possibly because of its unhip earnestness. Though to Mario he always maintains it's basically goo, Hal secretly likes it too, the cartridge, and likes to project himself imaginatively into the ex-bureaucrat's character on the leisurely drive home toward ontological erasure. As a kind of weird self-punishment, Hal also plans to subject himself to the horrific Fun with Teeth and Baby Pictures of Famous Dictators. Then finally to one of himself's posthumous hits, a cartridge called Blood Sister, One Tough Nun, that he'd always found kind of gratuitously nasty and overwrought, but which Hal has no idea that this piece of entertainment actually germinated out of James O. Incandenza's one brief and unpleasant experience with Boston AA in the BS mid-90s, when himself lasted 2.5 months and then drifted gradually away, turned off by the simplistic God stuff and covert dogma. Bob hopeless, Hal spits way more than is his norm now, and also likes having the waste can right nearby in case he might throw up. That afternoon, he'd had zilch in the way of a kinesthetic sense. He couldn't feel the ball on his stick. His nausea has nothing to do with watching his father's cartridges. For the last year, his arm's been an extension of his mind, and the stick an extension of the arm, acutely sensitive. Each of the cartridges is a carefully labeled black diskette. They're all signed neatly out on the clipboard by the egg-shaped glass bookshelf, and are loaded in the queuing slots, and waiting to drop, in order, and be digitally decoded. The 14th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment.
P.T. Krause, North Cambridge. That infamous, deceptive post-seizure feeling of well-being. That broken fever, reversal of fortune type, high-hearted feeling after a neuroelectric event. Poor Tony Krause awoke in the ambulance, lizardless and continent and feeling right as rain. Lay there and flirted with a blue-jawed paramedic leaning over him. Certain body entendres on expressions like vital signs and dilation, until the paramedic radioed ahead to Cambridge City's E room to cancel the crash cart. Manipulated his skinny arms in a parodic minimal mambo lying there. Fiddly-dee-deed the paramedic's warning that post-seizure feelings of well-being were notoriously deceptive and transient. And then also the little-mentioned advantage to being destitute and in possession of a health card that's expired and not even in your name. Hospital show you a kind of inverted respect. A place like Cambridge City Hospital bows to your will not to stay. They all of a sudden defer to your subjective diagnostic knowledge of your own condition, which post-seizure condition you feel has turned the corner toward improvement. They bow to your quixotic will. It's unfortunately not a free hospital, but it is a free country. They honor your wishes and compliment your mambo and say, go with God. It's a good thing you can't see what you look like, though. And the serendipity of Cambridge City Hospital being just an 8-block stroll east on Cambridge Street, and then south on Prospect, through mentholated autumn air, through Inman Square and up to Antetoit Entertainment. Maybe the one last place where a renewed, post-seizure, on the diagnostic upswing of still slightly shaky, young, gender dysphoric, might yet expect a bit of kindness. Pharmacological credit, since the affairs of Wu and Copley Library and Hart. The big brick cake of the hospital behind Krause in purple twilight, the brisk click of his heels on pavement, boa, semi-formally loose on his shoulders and down beneath each arm, hand holding red leather collar close to the throat, head up and staying that way on its own, steady eyes meeting with blasé dignity the eyes of whoever passes. The dignity of a man risen by will from the ashes of withdrawal, and now on the upswing and with places to go and potentially considerate Canadians to see. A charming and potentially, once again, in the not-too-distant future, gorgeous creature, with a renewed wherewithal to now meet the eyes of Inman Square pedestrians, veering sharply away from the residual smells of men's room stall and subway vomit, the ashes from which he's been rescued and risen once again, feeling righter than rain. A rind of moon hanging cocked above a four-spired church. And the emergent stars are yo-yos, you feel, after a seizure. Poor Tony feels as if he could cast them out, draw them in again at will. The way poor Tony Krause, Lola's sister and Susan T. Cheese became mercenary adjuncts to something dour Bertrand Antetoit had invited them to call Front Contre O.N. A.N. Isme, was that, for a heavily cut bundle to split six ways, Lola's sister, Susan T. Cheese, P.T. Krause, Bridget Tenderhole, Equus Reese, and the late Stokely Darkstar McNair had had to wear identical red leather coats and auburn wigs and spike heels and go and hang around the lobby of Harvard Square's Sheraton Commander Hotel with six mannish-looking women in the same wigs and coats, while an androgynous Quebecer insurgent, who filled out his red leather coat in a way that made Bridget Tenderhole dig his nails into his palms in sheer green envy, came through the commander's revolving lucite doors and strode purposefully into the crowded epaulette ballroom, and threw foul, semi-liquid violet waste from a souvenir miniature waste displacement barrel in the face of the Canadian Minister of Inter-ONAN Trade, who was addressing the U.S. press from a leaf-shaped rostrum. The decoys were then required to mill hysterically in the lobby, all 12 of them, and then hit the revolving doors and disperse in a dozen different vectors as the androgynous waste-wielding Quebecer legged it out of the epaulette ballroom and lobby, pursued by white-suited men with earplugs and Cobray M11 sub-automatics. So the security guys had see identical, epicene figures high-heeling it away in different directions and get fuddled about who to chase.
Susan T. Cheese and poor Tony'd met the Antetois brothers, only one of whom could or would speak, and who'd been in charge of the diversionary aspects of the Sheridan Commander operation, and had clearly been subordinate to still other Quebecers of way higher IQ. Krause and STC had met them at Inman Square's Ryle's Tavern, which had gender dysphoric night every second Wednesday, and attracted comely and unrough trade, and which poor Tony passed now, Ryle's, just after the Man-O-War Grill, now only a block or so from the Antetois' glass and novelty shop front, feeling not so much quite ill again as just deeply tired after only five or so blocks, that post-fever, sleep-for-a-week-type cellular fatigue, and is debating with himself about whether to have a go at the purses of the two young and unstriking women walking just a few steps ahead, both of their purses hanging only by the flimsiest of evening-gown width straps from slumped shoulders, the duo interracial, rare, and disquieting in Metro Boston, the black girl talking a click a minute, and the white one not responding, her weary stolid plod and air of inattention fairly begging for a purse snatch, both of them with an air about them of routine victimization, the sort of demoralized lassitude poor Tony felt always guaranteed a minimum of protest or pursuit. Though the white girl wore formidable-looking running shoes under her tartan skirt. So intent was poor Tony Krause on the logistics and implications of the possible purses dangled as if by God right before him. How different to hit the Antetois doorstep with liquid assets, to request a transaction rather than bare charity, more almost a social call than a contemptible, withdrawn snivel for compassion. So intent, as he sidestepped an impressive pile of dog droppings and passed across the broad windows of the man-o'-war, that he never saw his old former crewmate, Mad Matty Pemulous, a sure source of compassion, looking up and out and down and back up, aghast in recognition of what poor Tony has come through the corridor to resemble. Jeffrey Days noted the way most of the male residents of Ennett House have special little cognomens for their genitals. For example, Bruno, Jake, Fang, by Minty, the One-Eyed Monk, Fritzy, Russell, the Love Muscle. He speculates this could be a class thing. Neither he nor Ewell nor Ken or Daddy have named their units. Like Ewell, Day enters a certain amount of comparative class data in his journal. Dooney Glynn called his penis Poor Richard. Chandler Foss confessed to the moniker Bam Bam. Lance had referred to his own unit as the Frightful Hog. Day would die before admitting he missed either Lance or his soliloquies about the hog, which had been frequent. The penis in question had been that curious two or three shades darker than the rest of Lentz that people's penises sometimes are. Lentz had brandished it at his roommates whenever he wished to emphasize a point. It had been short and thick and blunt. And Lentz described the hog as a primo example of what he called the Polish curse. Namely, undistinguished length but sobering circumference. Easy on the bottom, but tears hell out of the sides, brother. This had been his description of the Polish curse. A surprising amount of Day's recovery journal is filled with quotations from R. Lentz. Lentz's discharge had moved the tax attorney, Tiny Ewell, up into the three-man room with Day. Ewell was the one man here with whom a conversation of anything remotely approaching depth could be held. So Day was nonplussed when he found himself, after a couple long nights, almost missing Lentz, his obsession with time, his patter, his way of leaning up against the wall upside down in his briefs, or brandishing the hog. And with regard to Ennett House resident Kate Gompert and this depression issue, some psychiatric patients, plus a certain percentage of people who've gotten so dependent on chemicals for feelings of well-being that when the chemicals have to be abandoned, they undergo a loss trauma that reaches way down deep into the soul's core systems. These persons know firsthand that there's more than one kind of so-called depression. One kind is low-grade and sometimes gets called anhedonia.
280.
Or simple melancholy. It's a kind of spiritual torpor in which one loses the ability to feel pleasure or attachment to things formerly important. The avid bowler drops out of his league and stays home at night staring dully at kickboxing cartridges. The gourmand is off his feed. The sensualist finds his beloved unit, all of a sudden to be so much feelingless gristle, just hanging there. The devoted wife and mother finds the thought of her family about as moving, all of a sudden, as a theorem of Euclid. It's a kind of emotional novocaine, this form of depression. And while it's not overtly painful, its deadness is disconcerting and, well, depressing. Kate Gompertz always thought of this anhedonic state as a kind of radical abstracting of everything, a hollowing out of stuff that used to have effective content. Terms the undepressed toss around and take for granted as full and fleshy. Happiness, joie de vivre, preference, love, are stripped of their skeletons and reduced to abstract ideas. They have, as it were, denotation, but not connotation. The anhedonic can still speak about happiness and meaning and others, but she has become incapable of feeling anything in them, of understanding anything about them, of hoping anything about them, or of believing them to exist as anything more than concepts. Everything becomes an outline of the thing. Objects become schemata. The world becomes a map of the world. An anhedonic can navigate, but has no location. That is, the anhedonic becomes, in the lingo of Boston AA, unable to identify. It's worth noting that among younger ETAs, the standard take on Dr. J.O.N. Condenza's suicide attributes his putting his head in the microwave to this kind of anhedonia. This is maybe because anhedonia is often associated with the crises that afflict extremely goal-oriented people who reach a certain age having achieved all or more than all than they'd hoped for. The what-does-it-all-mean type crisis of middle-aged Americans. In fact, this is, in fact, not what killed in Condenza at all. In fact, the presumption that he'd achieved all his goals and found that the achievement didn't confer meaning or joy on his existence says more about the students at ETA than it says about Orenz and Hal's father. Still under the influence of the DeLint-like carrot-and-stick philosophies of their hometown coaches, rather than the more paradoxical shtit in Condenza Lyle School, younger athletes who can't help gauging their whole worth by their place in an ordinal ranking use the idea that achieving their goals and finding the gnawing sense of worthlessness still there in their own gut as a kind of psychic bogey, something that they can use to justify stopping on their way down to dawn drills to smell the flowers along the ETA paths. The idea that achievement doesn't automatically confer interior worth is to them still, at this age, an abstraction, rather like the prospect of their own death. Caius is mortal, and so on. Deep down, they all still view the competitive carrot as the grail. They're mostly going through the motions when they invoke anhedonia. They're mostly small children, keep in mind. Listen to any sort of sub-16 exchange you hear in the bathroom or food line. Hey there, how are you? Number 8 this week is how I am. They all still worship the carrot. With the possible exception of the tormented Lamont Chu, they all, still, subscribe to the delusive idea that the continent's second-ranked 14-year-old feels exactly twice as worthwhile as the continent's number 4. Deluded or not, it's still a lucky way to live, even though it's temporary. It may well be that the lower-ranked little kids at ETA are proportionally happier than the higher-ranked kids, since we, who are mostly not small children, know it's more invigorating to want than to have, it seems. Though maybe this is just the inverse of the same delusion. Hal and Condenza, though he has no idea yet of why his father really put his head in a specially dickied microwave in the year of the trial-sized Dove Bar, is pretty sure that it wasn't because of standard U.S. anhedonia. Hal himself hasn't had a bona fide intensity of interior life type emotion since he was tiny. He finds terms like
joie, and value to be like so many variables in rarefied equations, and he can manipulate them well enough to satisfy everyone but himself that he's in there, inside his own hull, as a human being. But in fact, he's far more robotic than John Wayne. One of his troubles with his mom's is the fact that Averil Incandenza believes she knows him inside and out as a human being, and an internally worthy one at that, when in fact, inside Hal, there's pretty much nothing at all he knows. His mom's Averil hears her own echoes inside him and thinks what she hears is him, and this makes Hal feel the one thing he feels to the limit lately. He is lonely. It's of some interest that the lively arts of the millennial USA treat anhedonia and internal emptiness as hip and cool. It's maybe the vestiges of the romantic glorification of Weltschmerz, which means world weariness or hip ennui. Maybe it's the fact that most of the arts here are produced by world-weary and sophisticated older people, and then consumed by younger people who not only consume art but study it for clues on how to be cool, hip. And keep in mind that, for kids and younger people, to be hip and cool is the same as to be admired and accepted and included, and so, unalone. Forget so-called peer pressure. It's more like peer hunger. No? We enter a spiritual puberty where we snap to the fact that the great transcendent horror is loneliness, excluded encagement in the self. Once we've hit this age, we will now give or take anything, wear any mask, to fit, be part of, not be alone, we young. The U.S. arts are our guide to inclusion, a how-to. We are shown how to fashion masks of ennui and jaded irony at a young age where the face is fictal enough to assume the shape of whatever it wears. And then, it's stuck there. The weary cynicism that saves us from gooey sentiment and unsophisticated naivete. Sentiment equals naivete on this continent, at least since the Reconfiguration. One of the things sophisticated viewers have always liked about J.O. Incandenza's The American Century as Seen Through a Brick is its unsubtle thesis that naivete is the last true terrible sin in the theology of millennial America. And since sin is the sort of thing that can be talked about only figuratively, it's natural that himself's dark little cartridge was mostly about a myth, namely, that queerly persistent U.S. myth that cynicism and naivete are mutually exclusive. Hal, who's empty but not dumb, theorizes privately that what passes for hip, cynical transcendence of sentiment is really some kind of fear of being really human, since to be really human, at least as he conceptualizes it, is probably to be unavoidably sentimental and naive and goo-prone and generally pathetic, is to be in some basic interior way forever infantile, some sort of not-quite-right-looking infant dragging itself anaclitically around the map, with big wet eyes and froggy soft skin, huge skull, gooey drool. One of the really American things about Hal, probably, is the way he despises what it is he's really lonely for. This hideous internal self, incontinent of sentiment and need, that pules and writhes just under the hip, empty mask. Anhedonia.
281.
The American Century as Seen Through a Brick's main and famous key image is of a piano string vibrating. A high D, it looks like, vibrating, and making a very sweet, unadorned solo sound indeed. And then a little thumb comes into the frame, a blunt, moist, pale, and yet dingy thumb, with disreputable stuff crusted in one of the nail corners, small and unlined, clearly an infantile thumb. And as it touches the piano string, the high, sweet sound immediately dies, and the silence that follows is excruciating. Later in the film, after much mordant and didactic panoramic brick following, we're back at the piano string and the thumb is removed, and the high, sweet sound recommences,
extremely pure and solo. And yet now somehow, as the volume increases, now with something rotten about it underneath, there's something sick-sweet and overripe and potentially putrid about the one clear high D as its volume increases and increases, the sound getting purer and louder and more dysphoric until, after a surprisingly few seconds, we find ourselves right in the middle of the pure, undampered sound, longing, and even maybe praying for the return of the natal thumb to shut it up. Hal isn't old enough yet to know that this is because numb emptiness isn't the worst kind of depression. That dead-eyed anhedonia is but a remora on the ventral flank of the true predator, the great white shark of pain. Authorities term this condition clinical depression, or involutional depression, or unipolar dysphoria. Instead of just an incapacity for feeling, a deadening of soul, the predator-grade depression Kate Gompert always feels as she withdraws from secret marijuana is itself a feeling. It goes by many names: anguish, despair, torment, or which see Burton's Melancholia, or Yevtushenko's more authoritative psychotic depression. But Kate Gompert, down in the trenches with the thing itself, knows it simply as it. It is a level of psychic pain wholly incompatible with human life as we know it. It is a sense of radical and thoroughgoing evil, not just as a feature, but as the essence of conscious existence. It is a sense of poisoning that pervades the self at the self's most elementary levels. It is a nausea of the cells and soul. It is an unnumb intuition in which the world is fully rich and animate and unmap-like and also thoroughly painful and malignant and antagonistic to the self. Which depressed self it billows on and coagulates around and wraps in its black folds and absorbs into itself, so that an almost mystical unity is achieved in a world where every constituent of which means painful harm to the self. Its emotional character, the feeling Gompert describes it as, is probably most indescribable except as a sort of double bind, in which any slash all of the alternatives we associate with human agency, sitting or standing, doing or resting, speaking or keeping silent, living or dying, are not just unpleasant, but literally horrible. It is also lonely, on a level that cannot be conveyed. There is no way Kate Gompert could ever even begin to make someone else understand what clinical depression feels like. Not even another person who is herself clinically depressed, because a person in such a state is incapable of empathy with any other living thing. This anhedonic inability to identify is also an integral part of it. If a person in physical pain has a hard time attending to anything except that pain,
282.
A clinically depressed person cannot even perceive any other person or thing as independent of the universal pain that is digesting her cell by cell. Everything is part of the problem, and there is no solution. It is a hell for one. The authoritative term psychotic depression makes Kate Gompert feel especially lonely, specifically the psychotic part. Think of it this way. Two people are screaming in pain. One of them is being tortured with electric current. The other is not. The screamer who's being tortured with electric current is not psychotic. Her screams are circumstantially appropriate. The screaming person who is not being tortured, however, is psychotic, since the outside parties making the diagnoses can see no electrodes or measurable amperage. One of the least pleasant things about being psychotically depressed, on a ward full of psychotically depressed patients, is coming to see that none of them is really psychotic. That their screams are entirely appropriate to certain circumstances, part of whose special charm is that they are undetectable by any outside party. Thus, the loneliness. It's a closed circuit. The current is both applied and received from within. The so-called psychotically depressed person who tries to kill herself doesn't do so out of, quote, hopelessness or any abstract conviction that life's assets and debits do not square, and surely not because death seems suddenly appealing.